Good morning, my name's James and I'm one of the pastors here and delighted to welcome you to this very special weekend that we get to celebrate together. My family's journey to Canada includes Scotland, Ireland, England, Switzerland, the United States, the Netherlands, which is no wonder why some of you may find my accent a little hard to place. And this weekend is one of those moments where we get to celebrate the things that God is doing in our world, and we get to recognize that He's actually inviting all of us to participate, not just some, not just a few, but every single person here in the big room, watching online. He's inviting you to participate in what He's doing in His world. But what would that look like? Well, I get to talk to us all this weekend about this idea of the light of the world, which led me, if those of you get inside church jokes, to a whole load of church light bulb jokes that I started looking up. How many charismatics would it change to take to change a light bulb? 21. One to change the bulb, another 20 to share in the experience. Are Roman Catholics, how many of them would it take? None. They use candles. Or Baptists, they're kind of wet all over, but how many of them would it take to change a light bulb? Everybody. They have to have a congregational vote before they could do it. Anyway, that's inside our church jokes. You don't need to know nothing about that. I'd better just get on with the light of the world. The supreme light of the world. The light of the world is Jesus Christ. In John chapter 8, Jesus himself says these words, "I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life." Jesus himself says that he is the full, the final, the ultimate way that God reveals himself. He is God's light in his world. And yet there's still more. Let me read to you these verses from Matthew chapter 5. It really is the core text this morning that I want us to spend some time thinking about. Matthew chapter 5, verse 14. Jesus is talking and he says this, "You are the light of the world. A city built on a hill cannot be hid. People don't light a lamp and put it under the bushel basket. Rather, they put it on the lampstand and it gives light to all in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father in heaven." This is Jesus talking with his followers, with his friends, his disciples. And how is this supposed to fit together, these things that Jesus says? He is the light of the world. We are the light of the world. Well, who is it? Let's start with Jesus. And the way that Matthew tells the story is quite fascinating. Chapter 1 and 2 of Matthew is all the kind of Christmas stuff that you may or may not be familiar with about the birth of Jesus. And our Advent series this year leading up to Christmas will be right at the start of Matthew's story as we look at some hidden lights that point toward Jesus. And then in chapter 3, Matthew zeroes in on Jesus' cousin, John the Baptist, and we see Jesus himself getting baptized. In Matthew chapter 4, Jesus goes into the wilderness and faces temptation. He overcomes, and then he begins his ministry by moving house. Strange thing to do. He goes to Nazareth, where he grew up, and he moves to a bit of more of a seaside town, which I could get the point of. I like being by the water. He moves to Capernaum on the Sea of Galilee. And once this is done, Matthew then quotes something fascinating from the Old Testament, from the prophet Isaiah chapter 9. And he writes this, "The people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who lived in a land of deep darkness, on them a light has shined." For Matthew, Jesus is the bearer of that light. He is the bringer of light. He is the light in a dark world. A great light is shining. And the clear presupposition is that we're living in darkness when suddenly light explodes in front of our eyes. But up until then, we wander and we wonder and we're lost and we're stuck. There is gloom. There is a lack of hope. People are stuck in the darkness. I talk with all sorts of people like that. People who feel their life is stuck in darkness. People who feel hopeless or worthless. People who struggle about the meaning of life. People that are asking themselves the question, surely there's got to be more to it than just this. Certainly true in first century Galilee where Jesus lived. For centuries, the region had been occupied by one foreign military power after another. They were always stuck. Freedom was a dream. Life was dark. Life was dull. It was dismal. And then Jesus comes, preaching about the kingdom of heaven, bringing hope and bringing light to people who feel only despair. I know we live in a very different world today. And yet, for all the differences, it can still be a dark place at times. Political unrest, polarization, inflation, interest rates, war in Ukraine, human trafficking, sex slaves. Or maybe at a personal part of your own journey, maybe you wonder if you walk in the darkness. Trapped in a financial bind. Prisoner in a relationship you don't seem able to get out of. Snared by legal issues. Waiting for somebody to close in on you. It happens. And when it does, it's more than just a little cloud on the horizon. There is this sense of gloom and darkness that easily overwhelms us in how we feel. And it's into this kind of darkness that Jesus is bringing good news. Back in chapter 4 of Matthew, you can read this. From that time, and Jesus began to proclaim, "Repent, for the kingdom of heaven has come near." Repent just simply means to change, to turn around, to do a 180 with your direction, to invite Jesus into your life and then be prepared for the things he's going to do, for the changes that he'll work, the transformation that he can actually bring to your life even today. We get to make space for him and he gets to work. What does it mean? Simple invitation, a simple prayer is really all it takes. Jesus, I'll try. I'll give my life. What are you going to do? I'll allow you into my life and let you take charge and make some changes. You see, a relationship with Jesus isn't like some sort of business partnership or a marriage relationship. It's not that at all. It's not really equals. It's much more like you're inviting a new master, a new Lord, a new person to be in charge of your life. We surrender control, and honestly, we're really not that into that. We're much more take charge people. We like to be in charge of our own lives, not have somebody else telling us what to do. But that's exactly what a relationship with Jesus looks like. If God is going to get involved, then we need to repent. Jesus says here, the kingdom of heaven has come near. God's presence, God's rule are here, close. They're here right now in Calgary. You see, God's kingdom is not a realm. It's not a geographic place. It's not a specific group of people. It is everywhere. And he has come near. The one who rules in the hearts and lives of people, Jesus, has come near. He's ready for you. The renovations of your soul that he would like to undertake are good to go. Are you ready for him? Will you let him make a start on your life? We finished our basement this past year. It looks great now, and it was chaotic at the time. Dust everywhere, blue mats on the floors, people coming at all times of the morning and night, wandering through our house, doing whatever. It was utter chaos. And the most perplexing part for me, if those of you know, I have thousands of books. I just collect and read books all the time. I had some boxes of books I desperately wanted to keep. And after we'd finished building some bookshelves and putting them up, and I opened the boxes, the wrong boxes got taken away. Yeah. You should feel sorry for me. I feel sorry for myself. It's the big baby who's lost his books. My wife hears nothing about every single time I can recite them by title and author. Anyway, I'll grow up and deal with my problems later on. But see, renovations of the soul mean that kind of change too. Things are actually going to change. Some stuff goes that you would rather keep. And some stuff changes into something beautiful and new. It's the good news of the kingdom of heaven. God isn't far off. He's up close. He's right here with you and for you. Jesus himself is the light of the world. So if we're supposed to be light too, how does that work? How do we reflect the light of Jesus? How do we kind of get a job like the moon that's reflecting the light of the sun? How would that happen? Well, Jesus shines his own light. And ours is a derivative kind of light. It's a reflected light. By God's grace, we receive the light of Jesus into our lives. And as recipients of that grace, in faith, we go into God's world shining, glowing, if you like. For Jesus, the task of his church is to fully reflect the light of Jesus to other people. We're to light up his dark world. No wonder things need to change. Light is really quite an evocative image, I think. It could be a warning, a lighthouse, A warning of danger, watch out. It could be invitational, a spectacular thing to see, like the zoo lights that come soon. Come and see this. It could be lights as a guide, like at the airport, guiding a plane to land. And you know exactly where you're going. Follow me. Most of all, light is visible. It's seen. And so when Jesus says, you are the light of the world, it's not simply a descriptor. Hey, guess what? You didn't know this, but you're the light of the world. It is also a very clear imperative. You are the light of the world. You are the light of the world. We're supposed to be that light and reflect that light. We get to do those things that light does. It warns, it invites, it helps people enjoy, it guides. We get to do the things that Jesus does. We reflect his light. Not because we're amazing. We're much more like a window, perhaps, that you could see light through. A showcase for God's glory. One of the things I loved when we lived in Switzerland several years ago was how Advent was celebrated. If you're not familiar with the word Advent, it simply reflects the 4 weeks that lead up to Christmas time. And Advent was celebrated there with a particular kind of Advent calendar. 24 homes were chosen to be the Advent calendar each year. And I know sometimes people, kids get their chocolate Advent calendars. I like Lindt chocolate, and I noticed them in Superstore the other day, just in case you're wondering. And some dads get beer Advent calendars, but this was altogether different. Each home was chosen, and each home would decorate a window that looked out onto the street, but the curtains were drawn or something was over it, so you couldn't see in. Everybody gets their thing. They're showing part of the story of Jesus, the birth of Jesus at Christmas time. And they would get it all ready. And each day or each evening, the entire village would go to the next house on the list. The curtain would be pulled back, the light turned on, and it was like a showcase on the part of the story of Jesus. It was a beautiful thing to do. There was lots of hot food and hot snacks. And people being people, there was a whole lot of trying to outdo each other to have a more spectacular window than anybody else. But each window was a showcase. And our task is literally to be the showcase to show what Jesus can do with surrendered lives. That's your job. That's our invitation. That's the commission to be light, that we would live our lives as a showcase of a life fully surrendered to God and to people to see the changes that he makes. There's a couple of ways you could go about doing that. We could do it by sharing God's word, by telling the story. Your word is a lamp to my feet, a light to my path, we read in Psalm 119. And that's our job, to speak out good news, the story of Jesus, the gospel of Jesus, to other people that they would hear and discover. Because God's light can dispel all the sense of fear and darkness and sin in our world. The light of God's word, it can illuminate our way back home to Jesus. We get to tell others the story of Jesus and get a bird's eye view of the transformation that begins to happen. I told you that a couple of weeks ago. One of the things I love doing is catching people being like Jesus and they don't even know who he is. Because I get to tell them how much they remind me of Jesus. The simple examples I told you about, somebody caring for an elderly parent, end of life care, things are difficult. And I love to tell people how much they're like Jesus because Jesus did that. Dying on a cross, making sure that someone would take care of his mom. And we get to tell them, you're being like Jesus. I don't believe in Jesus. That's fine. You're still like him. Or looking after a little one who can't sleep and everybody's stressed and you get to take the shift. Because that's so much like Jesus, who's always pushing the grown-ups out of the way so the kids had time. He'd way less time for adults than we do. Or maybe it's spending time with people that are lonely, way down on the importance list. That's where Jesus spent his time. I love catching people being like Jesus and they're shocked. Really? Because I get to tell them the story of Jesus, of what he can do. It's an interesting and a beautiful thing that we get to be part of. It's about a relationship. It's about having the courage to say something in our conversation. And as God led our family to new countries, meeting new people, learning new languages, discovering new ways of doing things, making new friends, figuring out how can I share the story of Jesus with the people around me. Can I ask you today, who have you told recently? Who have you told about Jesus? In case you wonder if I'm staring at you, I am. I really am. Who have you told about Jesus? The other way I think we get to reflect the light of Jesus is simply by example, by the way we live, walking the talk. People who are kind and generous and caring and hope-filled and loving. People who are forgiving and put the needs of others first because we learn to love God and love people the way Jesus told us to. You see, a Christian faith that stops at the door when you leave the building, or if you're watching at home, stops at your own front door when you go outside, that's not really much use to anybody, to be honest. That doesn't help anything. Faith needs to be even more visible in the ordinary activities of life. It needs to be visible when you're at a store and you're dealing with somebody across the counter. It needs to be visible in the way you order food in a restaurant. Faith needs to be visible so that our employer could notice it, or if you are the employer, that your employees would notice that. Faith needs to be visible in the way we play games or drive cars. It needs to be visible in the language we use and the things we read and the things we watch. As followers of Jesus, faith should be visible. God's work in our lives transforming us, visible in an office, in a factory, in a mine, in the oil sands, at a schoolroom, in a surgery, in a kitchen, in your home, at the golf course, at a hockey rink. It should be visible and obvious. One of the things I loved doing when we lived in Amsterdam before we moved here to FEC, and pastored a fairly large church there too, we did something every so often we called Sunday for the City, or church gathered, but not on a building like this. In fact, we didn't gather in a facility at all. It was outside. There was no music. There was no sermon. We gathered to serve our city. Sunday for the City, we would call it. Teams of people clearing up riverbanks, cooking brunch at homeless shelters, taking immobile seniors for a walk in their wheelchair, renovating low-income housing, giving away water bottles and warm days to thirsty tourists, picking up trash in the park, playing with people, praying with people. I remember meeting a guy, one of the parks in Amsterdam. He lived under a tree, as it turned out. He looked like he lived under a tree. His life was helpless and hopeless. His best friend was his dog. We helped him get some food and began conversation, built a relationship, helped him get into some low-income housing that we could renovate for him. At Easter time, he chose to come to church. Nobody asked him to. He just wanted to. And him and his best friend, his dog, came along to church. Our church at that time was in a building where the platform was in the middle, which kind of is cool, except you have to preach like this the whole time, and you spend, like, you know, 30 minutes wandering in a circle. And at some point, you just hope you don't fall off the stage, dizzy. I'm up there, Easter Sunday morning, me and a giant cross, and we invited people to come forward and pray and say yes to Jesus. First person there. A man I met who lived under a tree. Last person to show up, the 14 people that service that Sunday morning said yes to Jesus. The last person was his dog. The dog came forward and bowed down. 14 people, one of them homeless, and one dog said yes to Jesus. Our words and our actions actually can point toward Jesus. So let me ask you again, how are we doing? How are you doing? How are you doing at showcasing the wonder of Jesus to others? After all, Jesus says, you are the light of the world. And when Jesus says that, he's not speaking just to us individually, but corporately, the group as a whole, second person plural. Remember a couple of weeks ago, I tried to give you a good Scottish word for that second person plural, yous. That's what Jesus is saying. Us together, by ourselves, we're like a little match. We kind of flicker and die out, I think, quite easily. But together, when there's a bunch of people all together, that light becomes much bigger, much brighter, much more obvious, like a flame. We are actually called to shine together. It's what Jesus has in mind when he starts talking about a city built on a hill. Even in his day, you could see it in the distance. There was so much light. It was obvious. Most people in the world are really drawn to cities. Then, now, perhaps better housing, more opportunities, new jobs, better education, other things to do, family, perhaps feeling a little safer. There's all sorts of reasons to be there. Cities draw us. And God is calling us to be like a city on a hill, existing for the sake of others and being visible. I want you to imagine a woman with me. She lived sometime between the 2nd and 10th century. There's a big time span for you. somewhere in the Mediterranean area, perhaps as far west as Spain, as north as France, as east as Syria, south as Algeria, something like that. And she needs to go on a journey. There's no communication. There's no vehicle. She just has to make a journey across vast distances on foot by herself. She leaves whatever shelter she did have and steps out into the dark, into a restless wind. Picture her? She steps onto her path, heading toward whatever city it was that held her hopes. She spends her days, certainly her evenings, scanning the horizon for one thing. Do you know what she's looking for? Do you know what she's looking for? A church. A church. Sometimes those churches were huge stone cathedrals that came out of the ground with their huge and beautiful stained glass windows. And sometimes it's just a little parish church that you may have seen in Europe at the side of a road somewhere. Sometimes it's a monastery behind a tall wall where there are beautiful songs and prayers being said. She'd looked for a church because of all the things she knew about what a church may possibly be. The one thing she knew was that its purpose was to be light in the darkness. It would be rest for the restless. It would be hope for those who have no hope. It would be the presence of God's love in a world that's filled with absences. Imagine what drove her, what she possibly was missing, what was absent in her life. Not just her, but still so many, even today. People who are hungry, driven by the absence of food. People who are sick, driven by the absence of care. People who are exploited, being driven by the absence of justice. People who are broken in every which way, driven by the absence of grace in their lives. You see her? Can you see these people moving and making their way, looking for a church? And when they found it, what would they find? They'd find personal care in those lighted windows, the consolation of knowing they're not alone, there's somebody there inside waiting for me. In an open door, they could experience a welcome and a hug. In our embrace, they could discover again the return of dignity to their lives. In our kindness, they find fullness of joy and a warm food and a cold drink. Inside her walls, they find somewhere to rest and to be safe. Inside her farewells, when it was time to go, they discovered they had warmer clothes and a heavier backpack than they arrived with, and God's blessing on their onward journey. That's what they found. They found personal care, and they also found public concern. Communities of women and men, God's church, who were concerned not just with individuals, but huge crowds of individuals, people in villages and towns and cities. It's the church, with all of her checkered history, and we know that, but it was the church that began to develop and nurture systems for the moral and intellectual formation of the children. It was a church who began providing systemic health care for others. It was a church that began to create music and art, not just for the elite, the emperor, or the king, but for everybody to enjoy. It was the church who developed and began the process of figuring out human rights that we still love to know are available to us today. The very nature of light is to radiate. Light a lamp and it shines. A village in a hill is easily seen. Nobody can hide a city up there. The lights glow for a long way. And Jesus is making it real clear to us that we are to be visible, to be light together, and certainly not to hide. People don't light a lamp and put it under a bushel basket. Rather, they put it on a lampstand, and it gives light to all the house. But sometimes we do hide. We hide the light. I met a fairly well-known Christian author one time. His name's Leonard Sweet. And when he was talking, he said that his favorite little song that he remembers from being Sunday school when he was little was "This Little Light of Mine." Everybody lights their little candle. Do you remember it? "This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine." He loved this. And the reason he loved it most was as a little boy, he got to say a bad word in church. Because when you get to verse 2, it begins like this. "Hide it under a bush? Hell no! I'm gonna let it shine." I'm not sure which was in Jesus' mind, but perhaps he was thinking about the people that lived down and close to the shore of the Dead Sea in Qumran, a Jewish renewal movement dedicated to following God, to loving God, to surrendering their lives to God. They were often called and called themselves the sons and daughters of light. They loved God and did their best, but they failed to live up to their calling. Do you know why? Because they kept themselves to themselves. They failed to let their light shine. And sometimes that's what we do, I think. We hide away and we hide the light. We bury it under a mountain of inconsistencies or hide it under a bed of indolence and self-indulgence. We come to church on the weekend, but we don't allow our faith to make any difference to any other part of our lives, not even sometimes to the people we're living with. Or sometimes we bury the light, we hide it with indifferent silence. We never speak a loving word for Jesus at home or at work, or even, to be honest, with the people you worship with at the weekend. Just silence. But we're called to be the light. And a living church can never be anything but a missional church, a mission-focused church. We can't deny the light of Jesus. It's the very reason for our existence. He is the light for the world, and he calls us to reflect it, to showcase it. Anything else would be to deny who God's made us to be. Here at FAC, we've got international workers serving all around the globe. And this weekend, I hope you've had the opportunity to learn more about them. And you still do. When our service is finished, you can figure out more. And I hope that right now, here, online, that you have the opportunity to make a significant decision. Because I believe that right now, God is speaking clearly to you. Is he asking you to pray? To pray for our international workers? To pray for our global mission? To pray that people will encounter Jesus who can change absolutely everything about them and transform their life and their community? To pray that justice will be done? To pray that captives will be set free? To pray that God's kingdom will come and his will be done on earth as it is in heaven? Is God calling you to pray? Not just occasionally, but regularly, frequently, with passion, with purpose. You could stop by the video wall on Main Street if you'd like to know a little bit more. People will have information they can share with you about that. And if you're online, ask the question of one of your hosts now. They'd be delighted to talk with you. Is God asking you to give? To financially support this ongoing work that we have, our international work? That could be in a structured and regular way through our mission fund. And you could start that today by going to one of the giving stations on Main Street and check the little box that says missions. That's where those resources will go. It might be that you want to support a particular project of one of our workers that you know or you've heard of. We've got two big giving walls out on Main Street, and they've got tiles there that you can pick off. It'll tell you what the project is. And again, if you're online, just ask a host right now. They'll explain that to you. But you could get involved by impacting somebody else's life with the good news of Jesus simply by giving today. It could be that God is asking you, to go overseas. Would you be willing to do that? Maybe it would be like I've done sometimes, to be a church planter. Maybe it would be in the career that you have right now, no change, just a location shift. And what you do here, you could do there and partner with teams of people on the ground to help them and come alongside them in this journey of showcasing Jesus to others. Perhaps it could be in a short-term team with travel restrictions having changed so much. The opportunities are again in front of us to be able to take people to see some of what's going on in other places. And at the video wall on Main Street, someone will help you or your online host. I remember being asked, how was it possible for Jill and I that we could move to another country and learn to speak a new language when we'd one kindergarten student, one toddler, and one baby? I've been asked the same question too when we moved again. And we had three teenagers, one in university, one in high school, one in junior high. How on earth can you go to a new place when you don't know the culture, you don't know the language, you really don't know anybody? How do you do it? you know what my honest answer is? You say yes to Jesus and you buy a plane ticket. Really? That's all you do. Is God calling you to go? I can see some people here right now who several years ago were sitting a little higher up on that rake. And God spoke to them in a moment like this and called them to go, and they did, and they've been halfway around the world. They're only here getting their visas renewed. How is God speaking to you today? Is he asking you to pray, to give, to go?